brought to you by FastFlight, your complete aircraft management software at an affordable price, all in one place. See us at fast-flight.com. And by the Evolution Flight Display System from Aspen Avionics. Evolution delivers unique reliability and safety features to GA pilots, and it's truly the most flexible and affordable EFIS available. Aspen Avionics, a new way to look at avionics. And by XMWX Satellite Weather. Never fly blind again when you add XMWX Satellite Weather to your onboard electronic suite today. Come see the latest from XMWX Satellite Weather in Sun and Fun, booth C24.
Hi, this is Mary Grady reporting for AVWAP. I'm talking with Dr. Harrison Schmidt. He was on Apollo 17 just 40 years ago and one of the last men on the moon. So he's going to talk to us a little bit about that experience and what it was like. I guess my first question, Dr. Schmidt, thanks for talking to us today. And my first question is, what was it like for you as the only scientist in the crew working with all these pilots, and did you also go through the pilot training?
Well, it was a great experience for me because it started with pilot training. I was one of the criteria for actually succeeding after you were selected. I was one of six scientists that was initially selected, and we all went to pilot training. It started out in Cessna 172s. The Air Force called it the T-41 to make it sound like it was a fighter aircraft, I guess. I don't know. And then we went into T-37s, the twin jet Cessna, and then into T-38s. And I flew T-38s then for about 10 years, getting about 1,600 hours all told in T-38s. Also trained in helicopters. The old MASH helicopter, H-13, was what we learned to fly in Pensacola, Florida. And then we used that for training. The whole idea of pilot training, I think, was very important. And I would recommend it today to NASA for all their astronauts, whether they're pilots or not, was to give you new experiences, to make the next experience that much easier to assimilate. And also, as Deke Slayton, our boss, used to say, it was a psychological trainer, because if you got into a problem, either you caused it or the equipment caused it, you had to get out of that problem. You couldn't press a button, reset, as we could in the simulators, and start over. So it was a very important part of the training. Now, taking people who were professional pilots and turning them into reasonably good field geologists was another problem. And I was responsible for putting together the training program for the most of the Apollo missions that was based on simulation. We'd take them out in the field, but we would actually run time traverses over real problems. And we did that for about a week a month for most of the crews in the certainly the last three missions, but also Apollos 13 and 14 undertook that same kind of training.
Oh, okay. So were you involved in choosing the landing sites based on the geological importance of where, what kind of samples you wanted to collect?
Well, I was one of many scientists that participated in that process, and it was something we iterated early on. Of course, the early launch missions were targeted to places we thought were the smoothest, and not science was not a factor. As we developed more confidence in landing on the moon, then we added more and more science was added to it. And after each mission, then we put the likely places that would give good science into a hat and begin to argue back and forth about what would contribute most to our understanding not only of the moon, but future understanding of the Earth as well. And so that iterated. And finally, for Apollo 17, we actually considered the far side, or I did. NASA didn't very seriously, but we could have landed one place on the far side of the moon. We had the photography and understanding that that could have been done if we'd had communication satellites put behind the moon. But in the final analysis, the Valley of Taurus Littrow was picked as the place where we could get the most new geology, new lunar geology, three-dimensional view of things that had happened on the moon very, very long time ago, 3.8, 3.9 billion years ago.
Okay, now you said in your talk that they're continuing to analyze those samples that were brought back then. Do you think there's still more to learn, or do we really need to go back and get more stuff?
Well, the samples are a gift that keeps on giving, and there's always something new to learn. A new idea occurs, and you go back and analyze the samples in new ways, because equipment technology changes. We can do things now that we never even dreamed we could do 40 years ago when those samples first returned. So, yes, there's a very vibrant lunar sample analysis community that continues to work, and publications come out very frequently. There are conferences. So it's still a very, very active subdiscipline in what we call planetology, planetary sciences. Going back, though, would involve going to new places and getting new kinds of samples, the ones that we're sure we don't have, because we only sampled a very small part of the moon on the front side, an area. There were just six landings, but they sort of outlined an area about half the size of the United States. Well, can you imagine trying to understand the geology of the United States with six landings? And it wouldn't work very well. The moon's a little less complicated, but not much. Now, the far side of the moon is clearly the place that we know least about. We've got good photography now from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's in orbit up there right now. So the most of the moon is well photographed. There's some other types of sensing that's been done. We would be in very, very good shape to pick landing sites for future missions. It would be just as difficult, because everybody have a different opinion about what is important, but ultimately that would be sorted out.
And do you think those future missions need to be manned missions, or could they just be done by, you know, drones?
Well, I think human missions have a lot to go for them, because the human brain is something that can be trained and reprogrammed instantaneously and based on new observations. And robots, that doesn't work very well with robots. Now, on the other hand, there are reconnaissance that you would do with robots. It would improve the planning of human missions. And after a human mission, there would be follow-up that robots could do very, very well. So I think the best thing to always consider is, what is the best combination of human and robotic exploration?
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Brought to you by Fast Flight, your complete aircraft management software at an affordable price, all in one place. See us at fast-flight.com. And by the Evolution Flight Display System from Aspen Avionics. Evolution delivers unique reliability and safety features to GA pilots, and it's truly the most flexible and affordable EFIS available. Aspen Avionics, a new way to look at avionics. And by XMWX Satellite Weather. Never fly blind again when you add XMWX Satellite Weather to your onboard electronic suite today. Come see the latest from XMWX Satellite Weather in Sun and Fun booth C24.